Welcome to the dojo, where we turn marketing stories into marketing tasks that you can do today to improve your fortunes for your business. This week, we're going to have just the three of us on the podcast, as our guest is unfortunately unwell. So you're going to be dealing with myself, Dale Davies, Head of Marketing Exposure Ninja, as well as Jess Percival and Tim Cameron Kitchen. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hi.
I actually want to know now, because normally we will come and ask our guests what your relationship is to marketing. I don't actually think I asked either of the two of you what your relationship is. So, Jess, what's your relationship to marketing?
Yeah, I am a digital marketing specialist at Exposure Ninja. Do a lot of video content, podcast content, and blog content. But previously, I've worked in-house for an agricultural company, and I used to work for an influencer marketing agency as well. So quite a bit of variety there, I'd say.
A lot of skills picked up along the way, as I can attest. And Tim, what's your relationship to marketing?
I guess marketing was my second love after drumming. And I practiced it by marketing myself as a drummer. And then built a website for my next door neighbour, and it turned into Exposure Ninja. Here we are.
I can tell you've told that story a lot of times, Tim.
I'm bored with myself.
Superb. Okay, well, we've got three headlines. I've picked one myself this week, and we'll turn the best one into tasks that you can follow. So, Tim, what's your story or your headline for this week?
My headline, this isn't new news per se, but we're talking about it internally. This is GA4 dropping conversions, changing its name.
Exciting stuff.
It's a bit of a rant rather than a story.
We do love a good rant over on the Dojo podcast, so bring it on. Jazz, what's your headline for this week?
Mine is lessons you can learn from Formula One team's event marketing.
Love it. I love that story more than I love watching F1. Boring. Sorry, all you F1 fans.
Dale, you are an F1 fan, which makes it even funnier.
Yeah, I certainly am. I've even got my little Charles Leclerc car on a desk as well. I do love me a bit of F1 when it's not boring, which it certainly is right now. Excellent. And my headline for this week is going to be similar lessons from, but this story is almost half of British consumers spend extra on high quality products. And what can we learn from that? Should we go with the rant first? Tim,
rant. We can get out of the way. Yeah, let's get out of the way. All right, fine. So, all right.
I always enjoy a Tim rant, so I'm quite excited for this, actually.
Oh, it's just, we've got war. We've got the climate crisis. We've got economic uncertainty. We've got AI. But no, hold all of that, because Google Analytics has decided to change the name of conversions to key events. So now, fellow marketers, we need to go and rebuild all of our training. We need to rename all of our reports. Conversion rate optimization. Is it even conversion rate optimization anymore? Is it not key event rate optimization? Like, of all the things that they could do. So this is, for people who don't know yet, this is rolling out gradually. And basically, conversions in GA4 are just going to be replaced by the phrase key event. So if you're looking for conversions in GA4, firstly, good luck, because conversions aren't in a lot of screens by default on GA4. So that's rubbish as it is. But now you've got to look for key events and all the stakeholders in your business who you finally managed to get learning about conversions and the importance of that. Now you've got to go and teach them all this new terminology. Why are Google doing this? Well, because conversions measured in Google Ads are slightly different to conversions as they were measured in Google Analytics. But guess what? Every ad platform measures conversions differently, so they never line up anyway. So this was a problem that nobody really cares about. It's a semantic issue, basically, and they've fixed it by just labeling the thing differently instead of tracking them the same. It's just annoying. It's a waste of time. It's a complete waste of the world's resources doing this. Google doesn't own the term conversions, but we marketers, it's one of the default things that we think about. To make things even more confusing, by the way, conversions still exist, but only if you turn a key event into a conversion to be tracked in Google Ads. So you'll still see conversions in Google Ads, and you'll still see conversions in Google Analytics, but only if they're from Google Ads. Google Ads is the only traffic channel that can now generate conversions. Isn't that convenient? So I just think the last thing that GA4 needs is for all of the training that's been produced about it to try and help us all get to grips with this horrible UI, this awful product. Now all of that training is out of date because we need to go and rename it all for key events. To serve what purpose? This is almost like, I saw a tweet where someone said, it's almost like someone is trying to destroy this company from the inside. I love that. This is the most anti-user decision in a very long line of anti-user decisions that I've seen Google make about its Google Analytics. So yeah, I'm done with it. I quit.
You had it here first, folks.
It's just a waste of time.
I have a lot of opinions about this. Just because I'm seeing this kind of attitude across a lot of different industries. And what I'm talking about is video games, I've noticed. They release games and they're not finished. And then they'll be like, oh, we'll fix it later. After you've invested a load of time and hype and excitement. And I kind of feel like Google did this with Google Analytics in that they released a product that was unfinished, because I went in Google Analytics a couple of days ago and I haven't used it for a while, and it looked nothing like it looked the last time that I looked at it, like maybe 6 months ago. And I am one of those people who created a tutorial. I'm not that bitter. It's fine. But I remember creating a tutorial for Google Analytics 4 when it first came out. And the amount of things I didn't understand simply because they'd given it a name that they had just pulled out of thin air and decided to name something, you know. And it would be like, oh, we've got events in GA4, but they're different to the events in GA3. So you already know this term related to Google Analytics, but it's a whole new term now, just for fun, I guess. And I can understand, I think we were having this conversation earlier about AI, and if you actually get on the ground floor and see the processes and see the production, you'd be able to make better choices than AI, right? And I feel like this is a similar situation where they're not speaking to anyone who's using this tool. And then they're just making decisions like, oh, it'd be better for us to call it key events because in Google Ads, we call it conversions and it's not the same and blah, blah, blah. But they're not actually speaking to anyone. Like, I would love to know who actually cares. Who actually was like, oh, it's really confusing that conversions are measured differently in Google Ads and Google Analytics 4. Let's change this. And I think you might actually find the number was quite small. I might get a message from a load of SEOs over on LinkedIn or over in Slack later saying, you are wrong. But I feel like it's just changing things for changing things' sake. And it's just annoying. I love starting the podcast with a little rant, Tim. Thanks. I think I needed that. I think that was quite cathartic to me. We're doing therapy today on the in the dojo.
I'm really curious how we can turn this into something usable. Like, a rant is great, but do you think that people should be dedicating their time to learning more about Google Analytics? Is this something they should be going away and like dedicating time revising their training or like spending time doing training on? I know a lot of people on their LinkedIn profiles will have, I did this certificate for GA4 and, you know, it lasts me a year. Do you think it's worth their renewing? Or like, what would you recommend to people who are typically used to the platform? Do you think they should put their effort into staying with it or explore other options?
Oh, it's really difficult to say, isn't it? I think like GA4 at the moment is the most popular choice. As long as you've got conversion tracking set. I mean, whoa, key event tracking set up. Like, I don't know what the action is. I would love millions of the world's marketers to head over to Google's offices with some pitchforks and stand outside until they reverse this. And maybe just bring back Universal Analytics anyway. There was nothing wrong with bounce rate and all these other concepts which are really useful. I don't know. The Financial Times calls this thing inshitification, you know, where things just get worse, right? I think this is the inshitification of analytics. It's difficult enough as a marketer to operate with the data visibility that we've got now, but with the existing platform sort of moving and shifting for no reason. Oh, surprise, we've just taken away this thing that you've spent the last 20 years working with. I think it's just like, if you're feeling frustrated with GA4, if you're feeling like you don't know what's going on, if you feel like it's really difficult to keep up, don't worry, you're not alone. Literally everyone feels exactly the same. So bring your frustrations that there's a video, a Google video, a 4.5 minute video, which is one of the most confusing things I've ever seen explaining this change. So maybe that's where we direct people to express their opinions on this. I think they've been deleting the negative comments though, because there's only a few and they're positive and there's just no way. So that's my two cents.
My left eye is twitching right now and I'm pretty sure it's drawn like because of this change. Like Google Analytics used to be like the place I spend most of my time. I used to just analyze so much stuff, probably too much time in years gone by, but it was useful at the time. There's nothing useful about Google Analytics 4, I'm sorry. Like, you can do some good stuff, and I would highly recommend that whilst the terminology may have changed, you go to Google and search for Exposure Ninja Revenue Guide to Google Analytics, or some of those words in there, and you'll find a fantastic guide that Jess has put together about how you can get the fantastic results from GA4 to like choose where you dedicate your time and what improvements you can make to your website. Forget about the kind of terminology kind of stuff, but yeah, it is useful and can be useful, but it's definitely worth dedicating your time to, okay, if I have to put my time into revenue focused stuff, marketing improvements, don't spend too much time going overboard on learning what GA4 can do, because I think it'll just be changed in 6 weeks anyway. So feels good to rant a little bit, get that out of the system. Thanks for bringing that one, Tim. Jess, do you have any more thoughts on that one?
One thought that I did have is about diversifying your platforms. We talk a lot about diversifying your marketing and making sure that you're not doing all your marketing in one place, but I think the same goes for how you track your success. Dale, this was actually based on something you said earlier about how you go into our CRM. I was trying to remember what acronym KEEP is. You go into our CRM and you look at our leads in there, and that's what's important to you. And I think that that's really important, because we don't just track conversions based on, oh, this many people clicked on a thing or this many people. We track it based on quite specific things that are important to us about our, you know, about the people that are requesting reviews or requesting to speak with us. So I think my advice here would be to consider whether the conversions you're tracking are what's important to you, or are you just going into GA4 and finding these key events or whatever they're called now just to fill in a document that you have to present each month that everybody's eyes glaze over when you present it? Or, you know, use this as an opportunity to consider whether your conversions are really what you want to be tracking. Maybe there's some other ways you should be tracking them.
Yeah, you've raised a really good point about the difference between leading and lagging factors in marketing and sales, where, you know, it's great to be able to track how much website traffic you have, but if none of it's turning into pipeline and into new clients or client renewals, it means nothing. So you got to figure out like what your business is designed for, what your marketing objective is, and decide where the better information is. Like, I've been looking at some SaaS products recently. There's one called Common Room, which a lot of SaaS companies are starting to use, which kind of does signal intent monitoring, like tells you when people are engaged enough that they're going to come up for renewal, or they're looking for a competitor, you know, looking for an alternative to the current SaaS product and stuff like that. That's a better way of like tracking what people do, and, you know, using that as a way to help your sales team pick up conversations with those people, do outreach to them, than any time would just be spent on Google Analytics. Google Analytics would just tell them how much website traffic they're getting. Maybe some conversions, if you're tracking your newsletter signups and things like that, ebook downloads, white paper downloads, useful information, but that might not necessarily impact your pipeline and how you dedicate your marketing resources, your time, your budget. Should I be putting my money into Google Ads, or should I be putting it into more content development? Well, if you were looking at just Google Analytics to tell you the traffic, you could, oh, all in on content. But the pipeline question and saying like all those bits of intent and touch points, that's going to tell you actually the people who get to into the pipeline and become net new, they're going a completely different journey that you cannot track on Google Analytics anyway. So it depends on your business. Yeah. Use Google Analytics if you have to. Track it for those early signals, but spend more time actually analyzing how people get through your funnel. That's what I would suggest from that.
But I think for most, you know, if we think about all our clients, though, there's absolutely no way we could make marketing decisions for them, or they could make marketing decisions without Google Analytics. Because you rely on, if you're going to base it on like CRM data or whatever, the number of times, the percentage of businesses where the CRM data is like truly reliable is so small. I just think for most businesses, the reality is Google Analytics is the main sort of dashboard of their digital marketing. I think it's really sad that we're even having a conversation where we're suggesting that website analytics is sort of like a, is there an alternative? Like this was a solved problem a decade ago, and it's unsolved itself by Google's product choices. And I know that there are, look, we've spoken to Publitics, I think Francesco from Publitics, which is an amazing like alternative analytics platform, which basically looks like UA, Universal Analytics, but with the data protection of more modern analytics software. And I wonder if we're going to see other alternative analytics platforms, you know, capitalize on this self-enforced, you know, unforced errors from Google, perhaps. Hopefully.
I wonder how much of the changes are forced upon Google because of the stuff you just mentioned there, like the data elements, and whether it's a case of their product marketing or product teams going, well, we've got to make these changes because of these legal requirements in the European Union, but also there's like, is it CEMA, the California kind of stuff, as well as, oh, the product teams are saying, well, we're doing this Google Analytics 360 stuff with our enterprise clients, and this is what they want, and this seems to do well, so we want to pull that more into into Universal Analytics. Well, it's not that anymore, whatevs. I don't know, maybe there's just a lot of people pulling them in the one direction, some of it forced, some of it unforced, and there's just nobody really trying to make it as simple as possible. There's nobody in the room going, yeah, that, and 80% of our product users are just not going to have any benefits of that whatsoever, which is a really important lesson about listening to your audience and listening to your customer base. Jess, your story about F1, vroom vroom.
Yeah, so I was doing some research. We are working on a video about events marketing. And what we mean is not hosting events. We mean the kind of things that you should be doing before, during, and after you attend an event, how you can kind of combine that with digital marketing. And I was looking for some examples. And while I was browsing LinkedIn for examples, the McLaren, I think it was McLaren, F1 team popped up in the sidebar. And I was like, hang on a minute. They essentially attend an event every couple of weeks, well, during the on season. So I had a look at their marketing, and the way they do things is really, really interesting. The way that they sort of promote their drivers as individuals, as well as having content about the tech and about sort of the more data-y side of everything, I found that really, really interesting. And I think, was it McLaren that I shared? I think it was, yeah. They sort of had a, on LinkedIn, they'd shared a post about the behind the scenes tech side of everything, and you could read this post, but that actually wasn't present on platforms like Instagram, where they were sharing race highlights, but also sharing interviews with the drivers afterwards, where they were saying, oh, it wasn't really a very good race and we weren't very happy with it. But they even turned a loss into content. Which, and all the comments were just people saying, oh, you did so well, next race you're going to nail it, you're going to do so good. And I think it was just a really, really interesting look into how they position themselves, like before, during, and after, and how they do that on different platforms too, how they build that hype throughout the whole. And I'm not somebody that watches Formula One. Now my sister does, and of course Dale does, so we occasionally have conversations about Formula One, but looking at it from an outsider, I just thought it was actually a really good blueprint for nearly any business to take a look at. And of course, watch our upcoming video about events marketing. But sure. I thought it was a great use of different platforms, a great use of different types of content throughout the events process, and just a really good case study for marketing. But it wasn't something that I'd necessarily seen as, oh, they're attending an event each week.
Mm.
But I thought it was pretty cool. I liked it a lot.
I've got a lot of thoughts to share, but before I do, Tim, is there anything you initially stands out from you about how F1 teams do event marketing?
I mean, not so much the teams. I'm in awe about how the F1 organization has marketed the sport, really. I know the Drive to Survive has been a big thing, but I think it'll be interesting to see over the years how the story about F1 maybe takes more influence in teams' decision making. For example, if I was running an F1 team, I'm not even sure I'd be that bothered about winning. I think if I wanted to maximize my sponsorship, I'd get people like Daniel Ricciardo, for example, who's very engaging, great on camera. I'd see, like, is Kim Kardashian up for racing for me for a season? You know, something like that. Where if your goal is that, like, brutally speaking, your goal as an F1 team principal is probably to maximize sponsorship revenue, right? So it's an eyeballs game. And yeah, if you finish, great, but it's an eyeballs game. And that seems to happen from around. I'm not an F1 purist, as you can probably tell, but I think it'll be interesting to see, like, if there is ever a sport that becomes more market, you know, like more reality TV, more marketing than it does actually the core sport. Because on paper, like, F1 shouldn't, I mean, it's difficult to work as a competitive sport, right? Because as like a super engaging sport, I always thought football is great because the barrier to entry is super low. Everyone can kick a football, so it's very relatable. F1, you've got a technical competency level that you need to exceed before you can even understand what's going on with the cars. Like, on paper, this shouldn't work. But it really does, and it's so massive, and now it impacts the, you know, the local economies of the cities that it goes into, and it's just, I love it. It's so clever. Really well done to whoever is the head of marketing for F1.
I think there's an awful lot to unpick from the kind of way that F1 does marketing. I think you have to look at, like, the pre-season, off-season, all that kind of stuff, and what each team does individually throughout the season as well to really hook people in. So, like, pre-season, there's a lot of, like, educational content that comes out via video and shorts. Like, these are the changes in the car from this season to next. This, if you're the first-time watcher, this is what you need to know. These are the kind of starting points you need to understand. What I really love is the brand affinity kind of stuff. So Jess was saying earlier about we're going to, you know, use every moment within the race to turn it into content, and we can go to individual people to kind of draw that out as well. So we'll speak to the drivers at the end of the game. They'll pull quotes that the driver radio during the race as well. So you've got, like, repurposing of content happening too. One area they're kind of pushing out more into in recent years is, okay, we're going to do podcasts more. So every F1 the sport has a podcast. All the teams have their own podcast. They have video podcasts. They have, again, splintering out, like, how can we increase brand affinity and, like, get our sponsors in front of more people to say, hey, we've got this many eyes on our brand, therefore you want to sponsor us because we'll get you mentioned elsewhere. Oh, we're gonna do on LinkedIn, the McLaren team and various other teams, they put out videos like, hey, I'm a marketer at Mercedes, and this is my day-to-day, and this is what a race weekend looks like. And during the season, like, this is how the season's going for me so far. They know the marketers, let's just say marketers because I'm a marketer, but, like, I'll see their content and go, that's relatable, I'm going to watch that, and I have more of an affinity for that brand, therefore I'm going to want to pay more attention to that team in the race who just so happen to have all these sponsors. Oh, Mercedes has got a Bose sponsor or Boss or whatever. Oh, I'm more inclined to buy a pair of Bose headphones, although I was gifted these by Tim, so thank you very much, Tim. But there's, like, all that kind of stuff. Like, you turn, like, individual parts of your team into a marketing unit of its own. So you can go to the engineering team and say, like, okay, we want to support you to put out content to talk about engineering, because all those engineering students at university are like, oh, I love watching the F1 stuff from McLaren because, like, I learn a lot and I really want to go to work at that brand, or I want to buy their stuff or attend races. And a lot of people, as Tim was saying, might not necessarily thoroughly understand what it is that's being sold, but they understand the brand story. They understand, like, the history as well. Like, Ferrari, massive amount of history they can pull upon, that they can put into new content. The Tifosi, that these, like, huge fans, they'll do anything and everything for Ferrari. If you watch Drive to Survive, all those people hanging around outside the hotels just trying to get photos and signatures, it all stems not just from the video product every couple of weeks, it's everything around it that makes people go, oh, I love this sport. I love this brand. I'm, you know, McLaren for life. I don't know why I picked up McLaren. I'm not necessarily.
It was because I mentioned them. That's why, because they were the ones that came up on my LinkedIn. Yeah.
But you think of like Red Bull, for example, it's a marketing company, not a soft drinks company, as Tim has raised in our previous brand analysis of Red Bull before, which you can go to youtube.com and search Red Bull Explosion Engine, and you'll see the video about like why they do what they do. But they've done videos just recently where they raced an F1 car driven by Max Verstappen against a drone, like the fastest drone ever created. And it's a fascinating video, but it's like, oh, if you love that, you know, drones and that kind of stuff, you'll also love F1 because it's technology and it's fast. And, you know, like, how can we take this audience and combine it with this audience and expand our total addressable market? So, yeah. It's quite fascinating, and there's a lot to pull out of it. I imagine we could do a very long video on like every element, like turn the driver into its own influencer brand, as you said about our friendly Australian Daniel Ricciardo. He's got like a fashion line out and does like his own behind the scenes footage too. Like, you could do that to bring it back to marketing and businesses at your business level. So, for example, we could say, let's take a business like a HR SaaS company, which is some of our favorites to work with. You could get the founder to be its own influencer brand. You could do behind the scenes footage with the people in the team. Like, okay, this is what we're building in our engineering team. This is what we're doing in customer service. You could just enable those people once a month, even. It's better than nothing at all. There's a lot of opportunities.
There is. You gave me a thought, actually. Well, both you and Tim, about how it's quite like F1 is a very high barrier to entry. And it reminded me, just while we're on the topic of F1, that in 2020, when they couldn't race, they started doing even more in the Twitch streaming space, because there's a lot of racing games. And I noticed when I went on McLaren's website the other day, one of the things in their menu is their esports team. They value it so highly that they put it alongside everything else on their website. And it seems like they found another audience and a new avenue, a new platform, marketing platform, that they could connect with their audience on in a totally new way. So I think that's another lesson here, almost going away from the, well, we've already gone quite far away from the events marketing aspect, but it's a good lesson on how they realized there was another audience for them in another place, where they could adjust their messaging a little bit. They don't necessarily have to have their drivers doing it, but I know at some stages they did. And I think that's a good lesson too.
Yeah, most definitely. Think of it as like the Happy Meal for kids. Like, you give them a little taste of something and they'll maybe get brand affinity very early in life that they carry on for forever. They play the game when they're younger, in their late teens or whatever age. They watch their favorite, you know, like Lando Norris has his own F1 esports team that they do stuff. They put out like video content as well. I was watching one the other day where they have like a YouTube Sidemen kind of stuff where they do like all kinds of weird things. But like, it just builds up the brand for Lando, which builds up the brand for McLaren. So they can, you know, help him to do that is beneficial for the brand overall. But I want to bring it back to a video that Tim made years ago about MailChimp. So Tim, I don't know if you recall, we did a video about MailChimp and did like a bit of a deep dive on like, okay, this is the type of content that they do. And there were a bunch of videos and things that I'll let you kind of explain to people what they're about. But the starting point for them was, okay, we're redesigning our website. So and there's like a lot of lessons we're learning about design that the people creating emails in our platform should learn to improve their emails. We're going to just share what we learn in the development of our brand and business, so other people can learn too, and there'll be, again, that brand affinity. We'll write out, here's what we learned rebranding the MailChimp brand, here's the stuff that we learned about tone of voice docs and blah, blah, blah. But there was the other bit of, you can do that for engineering too, but then you end up in a place where you make a whole bunch of videos. How were those videos, Tim?
And who I were honestly they can't remember now.
This might
so
be
much
different.
Water has passed under the bridge.
Okay. Yeah, we did a different video. I don't. Well, no, it might be the same one where they just did videos that just felt completely irrelevant. I'm not sure if it was that one or if this is a different thing.
Yeah,
yeah. They sort of tried their own Netflix, didn't they?
Exactly. Yeah, it was like a whole bunch of like videos about creators and stuff. And I don't know. I think it's very good from a brand point of view to kind of say we're a brand for creators. But it was, if looking at it from a performance point of view, or less so about brand, we were thinking, what are you getting back? What's the ROI of this? Because they're putting videos out that doesn't, they don't necessarily say, come and get your subscription to MailChimp or sign up. It was just, this is MailChimp. And
do you know, I think this is one of the issues with like B2B content as a, what am I trying to say? You see a lot of B2B sponsored content and they've tried to make it mass appeal, but they haven't gone far enough. So it's not mass appeal, it's not niche appeal, it's just in the dead zone, right? F1 works because they've got a mass appeal. The Netflix is mass appeal. They're looking to just get all people of any shape and size and age and location interested in F1. Then they've niched it on LinkedIn or whatever to be, here's how F1 approaches marketing, which is great for marketers. There is a danger that people look at this and say, oh, we just need more content. We just need to publish more content. But if they haven't actually thought about what does our audience actually care about, they're just going to end up in that death valley there where, you know, you see all of this B2B. I see loads of it about AI. In FT, there's loads of sponsored content about AI. And the engagement will be super low because it's just not interesting to anyone. It's not niche enough to be interesting to niche. It's not mass enough to appeal to mass. It's just dead. So I think F1 kind of looks easy and it looks like a straightforward story, but there's a lot more that's going on there, isn't there? They've basically chunked their audience into all these different groups. If I'm F1, yes, I want to target marketers because I want to attract enterprise marketing software companies to advertise on the cars. So I need to figure out how I'm going to get in front of that audience in particular. Like, I think they've probably built these sort of funnels, these awareness channels for each of their different audiences. And to a novice outsider, it just looks like, oh, they're just sharing everything, but they're not. They're being quite strategic about it, aren't they?
Yeah, I have to say, if I looked like I was a bit distracted while Tim was talking, it wasn't because I was ignoring him. It's because I wanted to have a look at the MailChimp Presents page and see what they have. And I have to say, it seems like now it's a lot more business focused. It seems a lot more relevant to their audience. There are still a couple of things there that I'm a bit like, what is that? But I do wonder if I clicked into it, I'd be like, ah, that makes a lot of sense. But maybe it's one of those situations where they were spending a lot of money, trying a lot of different things to see what sticks. Because there are still a couple of things here, like the Call Paul thing that they do, which that I remember that being there when we created that video, but it was quite a long time ago. And that's, you know, people speaking, business owners speaking and asking for advice, it seems to be. So it does seem like they've made it a bit more accurate, but at the same time, it does seem like they're kind of doing sort of dramas and comedies about owning businesses, which I don't know. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. And I suppose I have to applaud them for innovating and trying something different. But at the same time, if I was a MailChimp subscriber who was struggling to get help with my problems, and then I saw, oh, they've actually released their new full production animation today, I might be a little bit irritated that my money wasn't going towards increasing the support team. But yeah, you know, it's,
yeah,
it's, I think that's a tricky one, because you've got various different segments that they're trying to target. They're going to target people who are like solopreneurs or creators, I don't know, but they're also looking for like middle market, looking for enterprise. I think the branding stuff is more for like the enterprise middle market, where they're like trying to appear cool and flashy, and it's less about the enablement of the very beginning, where we want to help you get on the platform and get something out of it. It's more like, you know how to use a CRM or a mailing system. We need to make you think better of us to pick us over the competitors, no matter if our product is not equal to theirs. So like, we need you to be like very sold on who we are and that we're cool and the other people are not. And it's content like that looks cool. And if you get included in it, like if you can be brought into various aspects of it, probably not in some of these like branded story based videos, but yeah, we talk often about like bringing people in for webinars to kind of help them feel like they're part of something, inviting them to events. I think if you're an enterprise, you're probably like, oh, this is cool. I'm getting shown this stuff before everybody else. I think it's more for them. It actually reminds me, Tim, you were sharing a point about, as a Salesforce recently, or last year, about, is it Dreamforce with the big event where people are like going just because it's the biggest party and not because it's about how to get more out of the platform?
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. So the story was there that it turns out X number of Salesforce subscribers, actually they're subscribing not because they love Salesforce, it's because they love getting absolutely wasted at Dreamforce on their company accounts, which is why Metallica plays at Dreamforce, and Salesforce knows this, so they just put a big party there, and it's just basically to incentivize the decision makers to go to Salesforce. I mean, it's the most cynical marketing, yeah, but I bet that that has a higher ROI than MailChimp's irreverent and comedic alt history of the Lazy Susan. Or a fascinating look. This is a film that MailChimp has apparently funded. A fascinating look at the strange phenomenon of 1980s competitive fast talking. I mean, that, it seems tangential at best, right? That is...
I'm just trying to, like, figure out what the brief looks like for that internally. Is it... a brand person is like very confidently, you know, a VP of brand or whatever, they're very confidently saying, this is what we need to do to make more people aware of us, and we can clip it and we can have those ads everywhere to make people, you know, here's a little segment of this video that you saw as a YouTube ad, and you're going to go and look for the actual video and watch the entire thing. Or is it performance and they're like, well, our conversions are where we would like them, we're not getting enough leads through, we need more people to be aware of us, and this is a very different way of doing so. Like, have they exhausted their search marketing ability, not ability, but like how much performance, yeah, how many numbers, the volume, it's been exhausted in search, we have to try something else, and this is like really left field way of doing it. Like, I would love to know what that brief looks like. What's,
yeah,
the
agreed,
objective, MailChimp, what's the, what are you up, measuring it against?
Yeah, I like that. Just to bring
let
this
us
back,
in, MailChimp.
Yeah, please, yeah, please let us know. Just to bring this back to F1 and also kind of close off this section so that Dale, you can talk about your story. I think actually we kind of nailed a little bit of what F1 do with their marketing in that whole ramble about MailChimp, because if people were only fans of F1 teams because they were the winner, they would just be one team of Max Verstappen, right? He wins every week, whatever. And of course there are Red Bull fans, but there's plenty of fans of other teams that don't win every week. And you need to build that affinity with those audiences and give them a reason to love what you do, even when you're not delivering. And I don't want to say like, oh, just be really good, but then you just muck about and never deliver. What I mean is by delivering is when they're not buying from you, on the days when they're not buying from you, right? You kind of need to build that affinity if the win is the purchase. And I guess that's what F1 do really well, is that, like, for instance, just looking around my desk right now, I have a Sneak bottle. I can't drink Sneak anymore because I got diagnosed with ADHD and I'm not supposed to have caffeine. But I kept Sneak in my ecosystem. Then they brought out a hydrate formula that's caffeine free. And it took me a little while because it's not cheap. But eventually I was like, yeah, I'm going to get that, because they were still doing things to build my affinity and keep me in their ecosystem. And, you know, doing things that were interesting or related to my interests as a whole that weren't necessarily about me making a purchase. Or like, you know, Apple do it as well. Most people, there are a lot of people who upgrade their phone every year, but I just upgraded from an iPhone 11 to an iPhone 15. So obviously there's been quite a big gap there. But Apple, I feel, has done stuff that has built my affinity with that brand. I mean, they even have Apple TV, so they're kind of doing the MailChimp thing, right? But yeah, I think about the ways that you can be building that connection with your customers in the in-between times and how you can make them be fans of you even when you're not delivering something to them. Because whether it's because, you know, it's on a yearly subscription or because they only buy, it's kind of the thing that you buy every 6 months. Like, think about all those different ways that you can connect with them. That might not necessarily be, oh, everybody in our team did a Secret Santa, like they do with Formula One, watch our video of us buying each other presents. That's not in every business is that going to work unless you have faces behind it, but there will be different little ways that you can connect with people. Dale definitely has more thoughts on this. Yeah. That was the face I saw.
I've got loads more thoughts, but I don't know if we've got really the time to do so.
I'm really excited to hear about your story, Dale.
One of the things...
Actually, unless you have one
okay,
more thought.
Okay, let's be honest one then. I was just going to say, like, there's two items. Like, we have a mortgage broker client, and with them, you're looking for a mortgage, but the actual lead time between like starting to look into the mortgage information and actually getting a mortgage can be like really, really, really long. So again, brand affinity, hit these people at the earliest part of the funnel, make sure they're aware of you. So by the time it comes around that they want to close, they're going to pick you. Like, I know the data is there. It's like five, you know, the 5% of people that are going to convert, 80% of them have already picked the business they're going to go with at the very earliest stage. Like, it's massive. The first name you encounter tends to be the one you convert with. So yeah, getting your brand in front of people, your business in front of people at the right time is really, really important. And the second point was about what you said about come around subscription time and you're going to renew. The wow factor you give people at the very beginning of their time with you, your subscription or the services, the contract that they sign, has to be present throughout. Otherwise, they are not going to renew. So that wow factor may be delivered in the content you produce or the funky videos or whatever, but you've got to keep that wow factor level like high enough that people don't like just dip off and immediately start to search for other alternatives or just stop that spend altogether. Right, no more thoughts. Let's stop that right there, which makes it a great opportunity to remind you that if you haven't requested a free website marketing review from our team at Exposure Ninja, you can go to exposureninja.com/review and do so today. We'll send you a 20 to 30 minute video outlining how we can help you develop your marketing and achieve your goals for this year and the many years beyond with a wickedly sick high ROI. My story then is almost half of British consumers spend extra on high quality products. So this comes from a story I read earlier today, which is from Ipsos and Effie, which talks about how, well, the numbers, 48% of people said that they are going to spend extra on high quality products, and that 10% of the people want to own something that you can show off. So, you know, maybe a Rolex or a car or just some kind of luxury item. But there's a lot of people who are doing something called quiet luxury. Do either of the two of you know what that is? Jess, tell us what it is.
You're going to ask me what it is. I remember it. So I think it came about when, there was a TV show.
Succession.
I was trying to say Severance, and it definitely wasn't that show. Succession came about, and people really like the kind of outfits they wear on those shows where it's not big, flashy branding, but it shows that you're put together and professional. And that seems to be where the quiet luxury thing came from, is it's not necessarily the brands that everybody's wearing, but it's still expensive and it makes up like your everyday wear. I might be wrong about that, but it definitely was kind of like a TikTok-y sort of trend thing.
Yeah. So I've got some numbers here. So there are Google searches for quiet luxury that have grown by 614%. There are people searching for old money outfits. So this whole thing with Succession is that there's an appearance that people who have had money for a long time have. So, you know, they dress differently compared to somebody who comes into money later in life, or their family does. They dress a little differently. And some of the examples are that, you know, there was one that was like Gwyneth Paltrow will turn up in what looks like a regular jumper and sweatpants and whatever to a court appearance, but only if you were like in the circle of the fashion like sphere, you would spot that that's a £20,000 jumper and that's a $10,000 pair of sweatpants. Like, you look casual, but it's actually a luxury item. So it's like in stealth. There's another one of the terms, it's like stealth luxury. And there are searches, again, for like quiet luxury. I said that it has increased by 614%. People are looking for that aesthetic. But terms like old money outfit, 50,000 searches per month, like people searching for like, where can I get this? Old money aesthetic gathers more than 74,000 searches per month, which is like just massive. This is clearly an opportunity for someone to fill. But generally it means that this whole quiet luxury thing is that of refined luxury. Like, you have that appearance of having money without being too flashy about it. It's almost like a minimalist way as well. Like, you will wear very casual on appearance, like a jumper or a coat or something that looks very chilled, but it's actually very, very expensive. And you look in some of the homes and some of the like decor kind of stuff. People are like going more minimalist, having fewer items, but the items they have are very expensive. Like, you wouldn't have just any old speaker system. You would have like a Bang & Olufsen one, which is like a very expensive hi-fi manufacturer. Very muted kind of colors. There's a very specific aesthetic to it. And what I liked about this story was not the numbers, because with background and search, I'm like, 50,000 people are searching for something. Great opportunity. But there are like some companies that are paying attention to the market and developing products to fill it, which is what every business should be doing. They should just be paying attention to the trends, paying attention to what your customers are saying, and developing products or services accordingly. So there's a couple of like brands in here, like Bottega Veneta, Max Mara, The Row, J.W. Anderson. I imagine most of these are US-based. I know Max Mara I've seen somewhere in the UK at least once.
I literally never heard of any of them.
Have you not? Max Mara, I definitely know. Bottega Veneta I know from a rap song, and that's all I know about them. Excuse me. But what they've done is they've developed like really understated collections that are very expensive. So it's like £10,000 for a Primark jumper, for example. So I started looking into this a little bit more and trying to figure out the margins of, luxury comes with a really high margin, gross and net. Like the net margin for Hermes and Rolex is like 22% after everything. That's like over like a 10-year average, depending on like pandemic and everything. In the high street, it's more like 9%, 12%, that kind of rough area. The margins are lower. But both of those two sections, the luxury and high street, can both develop products to follow the market and make money, fill the product desire of the people that are there. They want to follow this thing. They want to be able to go into the shop and get it. And I find that really important from a marketing and positioning point of view, because you can go for like the market that you have and just stay there and create a product that suits them within their budget. Or you can say, I spot an opportunity. I'm going to create an entire new product range just to suit them. Like if you're Bottega Veneta, you already have like a pretty high luxury category of products. You can go a step above that and say, we're going to create something that we know you really, really like, and it's going to be super limited, and it's going to be super expensive as well. Like, so anybody who knows what it is going to say, wow, you're really, really special. Like, imagine like a limited run of Nike sneakers or whatever. Like, it's following what people want, following what people are saying on social as well, and changing up your direction based on that. Any thoughts?
Yes, I do have thoughts. The first one is make sure you know your audience really well. I think this is kind of what Dale was saying in terms of the trend listening and also the standing out, because I've also seen the other side of this trend. I would say I'm more of a maximalist kind of gal. And I suppose I ended up on that kind of side of TikTok, and we call this sad beige. there's this whole thing of sad beige babies where you would see these little kids and they're dressed up in all their sad beige clothes. And we've seen these parents, repainting their kids' colorful toys to fit their aesthetic. And I can imagine the people who are on this quiet luxury side are like, this is the coolest thing ever. And then you've got us on this side with a house full of Lego and pop figures and, colourful things and vintage clothing that's got, loads of colours. And we're like, mm-mm. So you definitely need to know, if you want to run with a trend like this, you need to make sure that your audience are also going to run with it. And it's kind of, you can start a trend, absolutely. Like, I've seen so many companies start their own sort of trends. Like, I feel like, I hate to say it, Duolingo kind of does that, with their passive aggressive messages. Then when people were like, your messages are really passive aggressive, they kind of ran with it. And that was kind of a collaboration between themselves and the audience. But make sure that maybe somebody in your company is like, oh, we love this quiet luxury. Like, that's amazing. But your audience actually are not interested in that at all. And they're talking about something totally, totally different. Or maybe they're not actually in that space as much as you think they are. So definitely trend listen as well as listen to your audience.
I think all of luxury marketing is super fascinating, because the difference between like an $800 Loro Piana jumper and a $25 Zara jumper is essentially marketing. It's essentially scarcity. Yes, of course there's a quality difference, but there's not like a factor of whatever, 32, quality difference. And there's certainly not that sort of difference in you know, usefulness. So I think this is like a sub-niche of luxury, isn't it? That you've got different niches within luxury. You've got very overt, very showy luxury, which I think much of the old money would consider as being hijacked by the new money. So it's interesting that you get these sort of these swings and the wave of different trends and how, right, okay, no, that's no longer cool. It's not cool to have Louis Vuitton like scattered all over your body. Now we need to be a little bit more subtle about it. And it's just like a reaction to that, isn't it? It's super interesting. But these luxury brands, they work hard for this, for that margin, like the scarcity work that goes in. Like the Rolex is a fascinating business. There's an incredible business breakdown. I can't remember what the company's name, but if you search for Rolex business breakdown on YouTube, there's an amazing analysis of Rolex's position and what they have to do to maintain this position and that price point over generations. And it really is, for many of us who are used to showing a mass market product and sell as much as possible, it's very counterintuitive to try and limit the supply in order to drive up the margin and drive up the desirability. But it's really a different world to what a lot of us are used to marketing and selling. And I think this is like the latest new flavor of this very exciting and very interesting space.
I think it's interesting, like, thinking of it from like a go-to-market perspective. Like, if you are going to develop a product or service, you really have to understand like the viability, like Jess was saying about earlier. Like, it may be a viable product, but the Rolex story of like how much marketing and effort to get us there, is it going to create an ROI? Like, you may understand the market well, but the money might not be there. You have to like evaluate all this kind of different stuff, which just goes to prove the marketing is never easy. And that's why it's a long-term investment and very rarely like a short-term kind of thing. You can't just like throw money at it, see no results straight away and go, oh, it's just not working, I'm going to call it quits. So you've got to like invest in marketing for years, decades, in Rolex's case, you know, generations, as you said, Tim, because like people have been like handing them down and preserving that kind of brand love over time, because then you're attaching like personal stories to it. And yeah, it's pretty fascinating. So yeah, if you are thinking about going up market or like creating new high quality but expensive products, you really got to understand if your customers are going to buy it and if you've got enough marketing acumen and resources aside to make it work out, because it's a challenge, but it can be a really profitable one margin wise if you make it work out.
Yeah, and you know, we've worked with businesses that have tried to launch into luxury from a standing start, and if you don't have that perceived scarcity, if you've just got a high price and that's all you've got, it's you're dead. There's absolutely no way you can do it. I think influencer marketing is a fascinating and important channel to build that sort of credibility quickly. But even with that, you have to be really careful about how you present and how you go to the market if you're going to build any credibility behind a high price. A high price isn't, you don't have a right to charge a high price. You have to earn that with an audience, and you have to have a very clear plan of how you're going to do that.
I can tell you, it's quite an obscure but quite enjoyable example that I think sums me up quite well. We saw this, the breakdown of this, in the game Neopets. For those who don't know, Neopets is an online pet simulator thing from the early 2000s, late 90s, that was massively popular. It was based a lot upon Flash games, and they had a full economy. The inflation got really bad in Neopets, actually, which is quite funny, because you could basically
always does without regulation. That's why regulators and central banks are here.
This is it. But there was a battle element to Neopets. I promise I'm going somewhere with this. There was a battle element to Neopets, and one of the best weapons ever was a single pea called like the battle pea. I promise I'm not just making this up. And there was a massive outrage because people still play Neopets today. And Neopets wanted to try and connect with more audience, so they gave everyone the battle pee for free. And it caused uproar where people were really upset about this. And it's really interesting the fact that they had created this perceived luxury of this thing because it was so rare. And then it just got released to everyone and people were more upset that it wouldn't have that perceived value anymore than they were, like, in, you know, in a fair society, you'd be glad that everybody had your cool thing that makes your game easier. But they were really upset about it because this thing that had been considered a rare luxury item no longer was. And I don't know, that's just if you want to see it in like a confined space of feral children, that's how you can see it happening.
I feel like we could do a really long video on in-game purchases because I think,
oh my god,
it's really fascinating, like the amount of money that's tied into it. So like there's a Counter-Strike 2, which is like a online first-person shooter game. You can buy like rifles in there and things. I bought a rifle like years ago because the game's been out for a while. It's now like if I was to sell it on the market, it's like I could get 170 quid or something for this computer little piece of code that, you know, you could either win or buy in the game. Like, there's so much money. I was looking at a website the other day. People are buying like knives in the game, flashy knives, like $40,000. Like, yeah. It's wild. Like, it's there's so
Counter
much in
Strike
there.
Counter Strike is big for it,
but maybe for another video. Okay, so we're going to turn one of these stories into marketing tasks that you can do today. Which story do we
It's a tough one this week.
Yeah, I really enjoyed all of the stories this week. I'm kind of opposed to telling anyone to have to spend any time learning about GA4. Sorry. I really liked your story about the F1 event marketing stuff, although we did go off in a slight tangent there.
We did.
I hope you don't mind me picking out that one. And asking you, Jess, which tasks, like things people can do today, can they take from your story?
I would say identify where your downtime is. And that's the first one. Find ways to connect with your audience during that perceived downtime when they're not purchasing from you. The second one would be find all sorts of different ways to create content out of what you have. The third one, if we actually went back to the original point of it, which was to do with events marketing, is make sure you're doing things before, during, and after an event to really maximize on it. It's not really enough just to show up. There's all sorts of things you need to be doing about building your profile so that people actually want to come and see you at the event, to then making sure that you have compelling CTAs and offers during that event that are really attractive to the people attending, and then afterwards making sure you follow up with them. But like I said, we've got a full video about that coming out maybe in a month's time, so subscribe to our YouTube channel if you aren't already. Just search for Exposure Ninja on YouTube and you will find us. But yeah, that would be my three things.
Excellent. Tim, which marketing tasks do you think the business owners can take and go and do today based on the F1 story?
I guess it would be this idea of, I'm not fully bought into this concept of like glass box CEO type thing, where you're supposed to live your life as a company leader online so that people can get bought into your story and all of this. I don't think it works for everyone. And I think there are many times there are better uses of a CEO's time than just endlessly posting brochure and value signaling garbage on LinkedIn. But if that is your natural inclination, and if you do have a talent for it, then I guess F1 is one of those examples where the story around the thing becomes the thing. And I think we have to accept that we as business leaders, we do have a slightly unusual and maybe interesting time, and that might be of interest to other people. So we could consider sharing this online in order to build up a bit of a following, which can then have a halo effect onto our product sales.
I'd love to add to that quickly, actually, with another obscure example. But most bands, their lead singer is their front man, their front person. But in the case of Fall Out Boy, their lead singer Patrick Stump is not their front man. It's their guitarist Pete Wentz, because he is the confident one. He's the one that thrives off that and loves it, right? Patrick is shy, he doesn't want it. So the lesson here for business owners is don't be afraid to let go of that a little bit and lift up people in your company. Yes, you run the risk that they might not be there forever, but I think giving other people in your company the chance to really shine, like we kind of do on this podcast, I think is so, so important. And it takes away that pressure from you if you're just not that kind of person.
I'm going to add one final thing onto this, like, in terms of like tasking that business owners can do. And I'm going to tie it back to F1 as well. Zak Brown is the CEO of McLaren and does incredible work to like sort out sponsorships, like the Google Workspace one, or is it Chrome? I think it's Google Workspace. But that Google partnership came about after Zak came on, and Zak is like fantastic at sponsorship stuff and like partnerships. That's Zak's background, doing like financial, like big financial partnerships and deals. Basically, Zak has utilized his network. So as a CEO, you might not want to do the building in public stuff, the, you know, glass box, everything, but you can utilize your network and say, you know, who's around me, who can help me to achieve my business and marketing goals. And if that's, I know the marketer at this company and they should talk to my marketing team just to hook them up, not necessarily in a consultancy kind of way, but like I can connect these people and they can create a partnership together. Like my friend is a business owner at X Software. Can our two audiences, can they both benefit from doing a partnership together and creating a white paper? Quite possibly. Utilize that network. It's much easier than going and seeking out someone, doing the outreach to find, you know, an opportunity. So that's another task for you business owners out there as well. Okay, well, that's the end of the episode. We don't have any questions, any hot, you know, quick fire stuff. But I do want to thank everyone for joining us for this week's podcast. Next week, I won't be here, but we're going to be joined by two fantastic podcasters. We've got Emma and Ruta coming from Blame It On Marketing, who will be here to join in the fun. And then I should be back in a couple of weeks' time. So if you have any questions or feedback for us, you can send it to hello at Exposure Ninja, and we will have a look through and see if there's anything we can do to improve the podcast. If you aren't subscribed already, make sure you do head over to ExposureNinja.com, and you'll be able to find all of our videos, our podcasts, and everything there. If you haven't also requested a free review, now's your opportunity, because spaces are running out. There you go. Let's add some scarcity to it. You have to get one today, because they're running out. There's none left. There's like three. Head over there now. So that's exposureninja.com/review. Request a free website marketing review, and we'll ping it over to you and help you achieve your marketing goals for 2024. Thanks, everyone, and see you when I'm back.
Bye. Bye.